There's not very many of us in North America. I think the numbers are like 25 or 30 total. So we're still quite small in numbers. And I came from the Amavati Chitthurst Buddhist Monastery community, so Ajahn Chah has been like a mainstay of my teacher lineage. And in 2009, I came back to the United States, and was a big kind of story around what happened and why, and if there's interest or a time, whatever, I might go into some of that. But from living in a community of many, I was then in a community of one. And I moved to Colorado Springs, which is where my father has been living for the last 15, 18 years. His health was failing, and I wanted to be around him to help and to support him on his onward journey. And my brother, who also is in Colorado Springs. The Colorado Springs is not renowned as a kind of Buddhist enclave. And so to go from being in a community that was very well supported to living on my own in a place that really didn't have a lot of support at all has been really quite a big shift. So I was born in Los Angeles. I was born in Burbank, California, and escaped at the first opportunity and went to UC Santa Cruz and studied there. And so in 1979 was when I was introduced to the Dhamma from a class that was being taught at UC Santa Cruz. So I was 17 then, so you can figure out how old I am now. And I, you know, from that first week of being in that class, I really had a clear sense that spiritual life was going to be central. And within a month of being in that class, I had a vision of being a nun. Now, I come from a Jewish family. We don't have nuns. And so it was really, you know, one of those things that was way out of left field. It was like, if you knew my family, liberal family, my father is an Orthodox intellectual, which means that he wasn't an Orthodox Jew, he was an Orthodox intellectual. For him, he couldn't understand things that didn't make logical sense. Okay. And so, you know, from my background, it was like, it was really quite a step into uncharted territory. And living in the monastery for decades has been filled with enormous blessings as well as challenges, because there are inevitable challenges in living in community, but also challenges in being a modern person with a university education living in a traditional context, with a traditional form. And the whole story of the nuns' community and what we went through and the ways that we learned and grew and the kinds of challenges that we have is, it's like, you know, it's a book. You know, it's a huge unfolding of, you know, what all that was about. But I came back to the States with a lot of blessings, of the blessings of this practice, as well as a sense of some things that I felt really clear I needed to move forward with and change in terms of my own, of what I valued and what I condoned and what I supported. And so I live next to the Garden of the Gods, which is a spectacular rock formation. And it isn't only that it is physically of magnificent beauty, it's tremendously powerful. And so that place has held me and supported me, because it's like a porthole. You know, going in the Garden of the Gods for me is like direct access to all pervasive awareness and unconditioned love, and it just pervades time, it pervades space, it pervades everything. So whatever challenges the transition has been, and they were significant, I felt well supported and held by this magnificent, powerful place in nature, which is just within a few minutes walk from my little hermitage, which has been very sweet. Yeah. And so, you know, my own experience has been more and more of, you know, understanding, resting, and touching into this awareness that pervades everything, this love which is unconditioned, the dynamism which is in the direct expression of change and emptiness that has no fundamental characteristic. These are all places that I I feel like I have direct access to when the garden is a portal. So then I would love people to come and visit, but my place is a little bit tiny, so I don't have, it's not like a monastery, it's little, but there are places very close by with motels. There's like a dozen motels within a mile. So if people wanted to come and visit, it would be wonderful. So I know Lori, I met her on Facebook.
No. We met on New Year's retreat at Hidden Villa.
Oh, that's when?
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
Okay, so I take that back. I didn't make it on Facebook. But that's where she invited me to come.
Yeah, yeah.
It was on Facebook.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so here I am, and I'm delighted to see everybody gathered, and I can sense just the guidance, the support, the love, the way in which Lori is holding the space and encouraging this group. And even without knowing any of you or talking to you very long, I can have a sense of the depth of her practice and the way in which that creates a context for each of you to grow. And, you know, isn't that fortunate? Mm-hmm. You know, one person takes a deep dive in and creates a huge oasis for everybody else to gather and to grow and to find your own direct access. And this is exactly the beauty and the blessings of the Dhamma. Beautiful. What I'd like to start with is just talking a little bit about refuge and precepts. And so, in the, you know, we have a day together, which is really wonderful. So we have many hours where we can settle in into rhythm and flow. And, you know, we were talking about, well, should we have it in this space or should we have it in the sanctuary in the main part of the church? And I looked at this place, and this place is so sweet. And then I looked at that place, and it was like, no way. You know, this is your place, and we'll all fit here. And so it's, you know, we're a little bit cozy. But then what happens is the coziness then begins to imbue the walls and the carpet and the chairs and the space, so that the practice that's actually done here is something that you can feel when you come back in here. So, you know, if I had thought that 50 people were coming, then I might have renegotiated, but we will be fine, you know. We'll be fine and we'll have time.
We have chanting sheets.
Can I see?
What?
Yeah, please. Perfect.
So pass those up?
Yeah. So, in taking refuge and in affirming the precepts, one of the things about that which is so important is that immediately it moves us out of the kind of small confines of our own little universes and connects us with something which is vast. So when we take refuge in the Buddha, we take refuge in those awakened mind. We take refuge in that quality that knows. And certainly you can see that the Buddha was a beautiful container of that awakened mind. But the way I look at it is that the awakened mind is not limited to Buddhists. You know? And then when we look at the refuge of the Dhamma, certainly we have the access to the legacy of the teachings that the Buddha offered with vast, informative, rich, instructive teachings. But we're also taking refuge in the truth of the way things are. And the truth of the way things are is present every moment. And that also is not something that Buddhists have a monopoly on. And then when we take refuge in the Sangha, you know, traditionally what we're doing is we're taking refuge in the Aryan Sangha, the people who have already awoken. They've had direct experience with the nature, the essential nature of the mind, who we are when everything falls away. They know that. Yeah. But when we take refuge in the Sangha, we're taking refuge in this aspiration to awaken. We're taking refuge in friendship, in fellowship, and the commitment to do whatever it takes in order to wake up. That is also not Buddhist. So one of the ironies I find is that the card-carrying criteria for being Buddhist actually is not Buddhist. You know? So taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha is actually opening up to the mind which is awake, the truth of the way things are, and the aspiration to do whatever it takes in order to release our habitual clinging and grasping and open to us to a way of being which is clear, which is wise, which is compassionate, which is loving, and includes all. So refuge takes us out of the me-my world, you know, my story, my problem, my world, my universe, my, you know, my suffering, and opens us into something that's vast. And to do that, as Lan said, of beginning to practice is a really important step. It's a bridge from the kind of ordinary world that we often are navigating into a world which has is suffused with the blessings of things that are not always seen or named. Then we have the refuge, or that we can take the precepts, and the precepts create a container of safety. And so, you know, we can be clear and comfortable that we can be together and relax into something where we are all on the same page. So the first precept is to refrain from killing any living being. Then the second is to refrain from stealing or taking anything that's not given. And the third is to refrain from any kind of sexual misconduct. And the fourth is to refrain from speech which is harmful or divisive or slanderous or useless. And the fifth is to refrain from drugs and drink which cloud and confuse the mind. You know, I don't think that anyone is actually going to have an issue wanting to kill somebody today. I might be wrong. But on a much subtler reflection, what that precept actually asks us to do is to not harm anything, including ourselves. And if we are honest and really look, there are an unbelievable ways in which we are constantly hurting, harming, slandering, belittling, shaming ourselves. And it's endless. It just goes on as wallpaper. You know? We're not good enough. We didn't do it right. There's something fundamentally wrong with us. So if we are to genuinely and sincerely take that first precept to heart, it means that we have to have some kind of time out on this wallpaper, belief, activity, verbal way that we're related to ourselves. It's no longer okay to slam, to shame, to slander, to berate, to criticize, to undermine, to devalue ourselves in a way that we have done for 100 years and never even noticed that we were doing it. Got to stop that. And when we stop doing that to ourselves, so we put ourselves down like that, then we begin to have more capacity for not doing it with each other. And it has to start with ourselves, it has to. And if the whole thing that happens today is that we get a little bit more leverage in not harming ourselves, then it would be a magnificently and wildly successful day-long retreat. Okay? If that is the only thing. Yes?
We should have a thought on that. Is those are all good things to avoid, and probably the deepest is thriving on those, is being rewarded by those negativities.
So we have a whole learning of, if we cannot let go of locating ourselves as being bad or wrong or shameful or all of those things, if we can't let go of locating ourselves there, then we can't change. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're opening up a whole other big can of worms, which is that it isn't only just the good idea It's navigating the dislocation of not knowing who we are if that's not what we are believing about ourselves. Yeah. And that takes a lot of ground, a lot of compassion, and a lot of friendship. Because there are times when we can't feel for ourselves what makes sense. And then it's the warmth of somebody else who says, I see you. I see your beauty. I see your smile. I see your goodness. And it's not okay for you to do all of those shaming things in front of me. That's not acceptable. I won't stand by, observe that, and just not say anything. Yeah. So the first precept of non-harming actually takes us into a deep dive, where for many of us we have lifelong patterns that really need time out. We need to say no. This no longer is life-affirming, and it's no longer something I'm willing to do. And that takes guts to stop doing that. Just because in exactly the way you mentioned, when we stop doing what we are used to, we don't know who we are. So the precept of non-harming and then the precept of not taking what's not given. You know, I have my own school, and this is the main way that I receive food. This is how I eat most of the time. And even in Colorado, I go on Ultra, which is far out experience. And, you know, I don't say when I have my alms bowl, you know, I'm a lacto-ovary vegetarian and I don't like ketchup and please have it only be organic. You know, I don't say that. The alms bowl is open and whatever anybody offers, I receive it. Okay? And there's a whole training and learning how to tune into the generosity of what is given rather than the taste or the pleasure or the preference of what is given. Yeah? Well, in the same way, our bodies are like alms bowls in the sense that what we have to deal with in our minds, the sensations that we're experiencing, is what is offered. You know, so many of us can have a long list of our preferences. I want joy, I want rapture, I want concentration, I want energy, I want insight, I want to let go, I want to feel connected. So we can have a long list of expectations. And sometimes it's helpful just to take note of what are the expectations that you came here with. What do you think is going to happen? And notice it and put it aside. Okay? So the practice of having an alms bowl and the practice of having a mind, a body, and a heart on meditation is to be open to what is received. So sometimes there might be pain, physical discomfort or emotional pain as different kinds of memories come up that are unsettling, you know. That's what's offered. And our challenge is to finesse our way into being present with it and not suffering. That's our joy. That's our challenge, is to be with things as they are and to release the tension and contraction around it. Yeah? The third precept around refraining from sexual misconduct. Okay, so this is not the place to find the life partner of your preference today. If you come with your life partner of your preference, then we will rejoice.
Before you come, would you please find a box of tissue? Thank you. Since you're coming this way.
And, you know,
hello, everyone. Just my life partner of the tissue.
Now we need to apologize.
This is the song you're working together.
There's a big discussion about working with our sexual energy in a way which is honoring. And, you know, it's something that's an important discussion for me. Partly because, you know, I've lived in many Dhamma contexts where there's not very often this conversation that's actually meaningful. It's more often cursory. And this is really quite important part of our lives. And this is true whether we're in relationship or celibate. You know? Just because we wear robes doesn't mean that this all evaporates. And so, you know, learning how to be at peace with this whole part of our life is important, and understanding the kind of appropriate boundaries around what is skillful and what creates joy and respect and friendship and what undermines that. So that's a big conversation. But on a subtler level, you know, the way we relate to sense input is also something that's important. And in our culture, there's an awful lot of kind of cultural pressure to have a lot of sense input, and not necessarily with any sense of the consequence of where that is coming from or the effect that it has on the earth or what it does to our nervous system or, you know, any of that. So it's a big conversation, but we're not going to necessarily have time for it today. But just to flag that when we take the third precept, we're opening up this as a possibility for inquiry. And then the fourth precept, to refrain from incorrect speech, not harmful speech or divisive speech or slander or useless speech or swearing, except when I'm with my punks, then I'm allowed. It's required. You have to speak the language of the people. But on a subtler level, what we need to look at is the way our thoughts are precursors to our speech. And so in the same way that the first precept is to refrain from harmful actions, the fourth precept really has us dial in to what are we following in terms of the kinds of thoughts that are going on in our minds. You know, are they harmful? Are they compassionate? Are they slanderous? Is it divisive? Is it useful? Is it useless? So, you know, when we dial in, we begin to have a closer look at some of the stuff that's going on, and, you know, checking out and seeing, well, really, how am I with what's going on with the thinking? And that's during the course of the day. We'll work with that. Yeah. And then the fifth precept is to refrain from drugs and drink, which confuse and cause cloudiness and inability to be clear. And, you know, many of my friends are in recovery, and certainly I know that without sobriety, it's like you don't really have a basis for contemplation. You know, you don't have enough foundation to look at what's going on. So sobriety is like really is fundamental. It's absolutely fundamental, and whatever is needed in order to support people to be sober and to stay sober really needs to be a kind of like bedrock commitment of a community. It needs to be really, really strong. For myself, I never journeyed through the world of addiction of substances. I was addicted to bliss. So what that meant is that it was just like ordinary things were intolerable for me. It was just like absolute, like felt like death, you know, total annihilation. Just to experience something that was ordinary. So I would squeeze things in order to get bliss out of the something, you know? And for me, just learning how to let it be, you know, without squeezing it, without, you know, angling it in a particular way, it was a huge practice and a huge letting go. Huge. You know, just letting it be the way it was. So each of us, you know, we've got our own kind of predicaments or tendencies or angles on things, and we need to know what they are and understand the precepts and ways that support us giving some traction so that we can move towards balance and towards health and to move away from what no longer serves. So, shall we affirm the refuges and the precepts? Is that okay? Yeah. So, you know, I never demand people do practices. I'm always only offering things on invitation. And so if there's a feeling that this is not in resonance with But even on that, don't feel like you have to follow the group under that. But if these principles and if these precepts do feel resonant, then what I'd like to recommend is that we go through the Pali chanting and we formally take them. When we're doing the Pali chanting, rather than focus on the Pali, focus on your understanding of what these mean for you. Okay? So rather than trying to get the words out right, see if you can really touch in how these actually settle and land for you. Okay? So let's start with a Namo Tassa. I will do three times and then you repeat after me. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa.
Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa.
Focusing in on these refuge and what they mean for you as you repeat after me. Buddham saranam gacchami.
Buddham saranam gacchami.
Dhammam saranam gacchami.
Dhammam saranam gacchami.
Sangham saranam gacchami.
Sangham saranam gacchami.
Dvitiyam hi buddham saranam gacchami.
Dvitiyam hi buddham saranam gacchami.
Dvitiyam hi dhammam saranam gacchami.
Dvitiyam hi dhammam saranam gacchami.
Dvitiyam hi sangham saranam gacchami.
Dvitiyam hi sangham saranam gacchami.
Tatiyam hi buddham saranam gacchami.
Tatiyam hi buddham saranam gacchami.
Tatiyam hi dhammam saranam gacchami.
Tatiyam hi dhammam saranam gacchami.
Tatiyam hi sangham saranam gacchami.
Tatiyam hi sangham saranam gacchami.
Another precepts. Panatipata veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami.
Panatipata veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami.
I undertake the precept to refrain from taking the life of any living being.
I undertake the precept to refrain from taking the life of any living being.
Padinadana veramane sikkhapadam samadhiyami.
Padinadana veramane sikkhapadam samadhiyami.
I undertake the precept to refrain from taking that which is not given. Kahame samichara veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami.
Kahame samichara veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami.
I undertake the precept to refrain from sensual misconduct. Take the precept to refrain from false and harmful speech. To refrain from consuming intoxicating drink and drugs which lead to carelessness. So what this last blessing chant is have morality as a vehicle for happiness, as morality is a vehicle for good fortune, as morality is a vehicle for insight, liberation.
Sadhu.
So what I'd like to do is to begin the meditation, the sitting meditation, asking you to stand. Zabutan. And what's helpful is to let your feet spread out, your toes spread out, and just feel your feet on the carpet or on the floor. And in the balls of the feet is an energy point, an acupressure point, kidney point. And if you open that point and then just energetically connect with the earth beneath us. So you can do that with imagination or visualization. You can imagine roots coming through the bottom of your feet. You can imagine a steel girders coming through the bottom of your feet. You can imagine being in an elevator that goes into the earth, or being in a waterfall that goes into the earth. And what's really helpful is that as we energetically connect with the earth, just to notice what happens to the rest of the muscles in your body. And when I do that, I notice a relaxation. It's like I am not feeling like I have to do it all by myself. Like I feel the support of the earth. Now, grounding is not part of the early Buddhist teachings, not part of the early Buddhist instructions. And I have found it enormously useful, complementary practice to then be able to use the mindfulness instructions and to maximum benefit. So when I energetically connect with the earth, I immediately relax. And then I can follow that immediate relaxation and make an invitation to continue to relax. So we want to relax our ankles and want to relax knees so that they're slightly bent. And then when we're standing, what's really helpful is to tuck the sitting bones under. So if we had a nice big bushy tail like a coyote, and we tucked it between our legs, then our sitting bones would be tucked under. And the sitting bones tucked under, then the spine then moves out of the sacrum, elongating. And then the shoulders can roll back slightly. And the neck elongates, and as the neck elongates, the chin tucks in slightly. The jaw can relax and open. The top of the head is the highest point. The fingers can rest curled at the side of the legs. So this is standing. And, you know, one of the things that has happened in our Western, the Vipassana world, is that sitting has become synonymous with meditation. And so, you know, we don't say, somebody introduced me, this is Amatanasanti who sat with Ajahn Sumedho in England for 20 years. Can you imagine sitting with Ajahn Sumedho for 20 years? So meditation is not about sitting, it's about bringing awareness into everything that is happening. And sitting is one posture that we can use, and a useful posture, but it is one posture. It is not the sum total of the postures we use in meditation. Standing is really useful because many of us have a challenge to feel grounded and connected with the earth and our own body. And because it requires more balance, we have to be embodied in a different way when we're standing. They have to be altogether present. It's also really useful when there's pain in the back. Sometimes sitting is actually not so helpful. When there's a lot of pain, there needs to be a lot of softness, a lot of skillfulness, and the right kind of measure of breath and relaxation to work with pain and not tighten up with it or actually exacerbate it. So please feel welcome today at any point in the day. If you're either too sleepy to stay connected or there's too much pain in your legs to work with in a balanced and useful way, you can very quietly stand up. So we're not interested in everyone doing what everyone else is doing. We're interested in connecting with what is needed to be responsive in the present moment, alive, connected, grounded, balanced, and responsive. And sometimes it means that what we need to do is a little bit different. So when there's so many people, we need to be careful that we are quiet and respectful. But we don't need to use the sense of quiet and respectful to learn how to be unresponsive to what is needed in the present moment. But to dial into another level of taking care of our own needs as well as protecting the group. That the group can dive into depth. So we can relax the whole body. And we can also energize the whole body. So this valley is a fertile valley. There is all kinds of wonderful things that can grow here. And when we can tune into the land that's underneath us, we can allow the vitality of the earth underneath us to also energize. So we can relax and let the tension release into the earth. And we can energize and let the vitality of the earth support us. So we can use those places in the bottom of our feet to receive the vitality of the earth and mixing the vitality of the earth with breath and awareness, energize feet, allowing the energy of the earth to invigorate, enliven, awaken feet and ankles and legs, knees, thighs, and just noticing the sensations as they change, movement, tingling, without any requirement that it be different or that it be more, just open and receptive, allowing what is. Hips, pelvic floor, the lower part of the torso, middle part of the torso, upper part of the torso, shoulders, and letting the fingers come alive, the hands come alive with breath, awareness, and the vitality of the earth. The lower part of the arm, the upper part of the arm, again the shoulders, neck, jaw, mouth, tongue, cheeks, eyes, behind the eyes, forehead, and back of the head, top of the head. Now, telescoping out so we have a whole view of the whole body, breathing in the vitality, awareness, and breath into the whole body. Lungs, organs, blood, bones, ligaments, muscles, tissues, cells, nervous system, endocrine system, the whole body, breathing in vitality, awareness, and breath, breathing out what is no longer useful, stale, stagnant. And now the invitation is to change posture and come into sitting. With interest, curiosity, what that will feel like as a meditation. Changing posture as a meditation. So take your time. So just in the same way that standing is useful to get the posture aligned, we can also do the same with sitting. Now, one of the things about chairs is that most chairs have been designed by people who've gone through a very specialized engineering school. And that engineering school is specifically designed to make a chair so that it is impossible for your back to be upright. They're specially designed. You can't graduate from the school until you can design a chair that makes it impossible for your back to be upright. So one of the ways in which we can counteract that is to sit on the front part of the chair. So if you've got back issues where you need the support of the back, then enjoy the support of the back. But if you can manage on the front part of the chair, then what happens is that your back is not leaning back, and then it's not curved, which means that your breathing is not impeded and that you don't have to counteract the force of gravity. So the irony is that the chairs are supposed to be comfortable, and what really happens is that it makes it really tiring to sit there for a while. Good marketing. Bad for meditation. So, on the edge of the chair, with your feet flat on the ground, and what you want is your back to elongate naturally. So you don't want to have to pull your shoulders up with your shoulders. So let's see what that feels like if we exaggerate it. Just let your shoulders come all the way up to your ears. And just feel what that feels like. You know, is this lovely, peaceful, relaxing? No, it's horrible. So let that drop. And then let's collapse and let's see what it feels like to do this. You know, is that possible to breathe? No. So what we want to do is we want to find something that's balanced, that's aligned and relaxed. So to sit, what's happening is that our tailbone is in the opposite configuration as when we're standing. So if when we are standing we tuck our tailbones under, then when we're sitting we want our tailbones to be slightly back. So if we had a tail, our tail would be up, not under. We would not tuck it between our legs, it would be up and bushy. So what that means is the top of our hips are slightly forward of our sitting bones. And if we can get the top of our hips just slightly forward of our sitting bones, then what happens is that the spine is able to elongate with the minimal amount of effort needed. Minimal effort is what we're looking for. So sometimes you need to fiddle cushions to get enough height underneath your hips. Sometimes you need to add cushions. Sometimes what's needed is to change the cushion so that what you're sitting with is not with your legs folded in front but to the back. So sometimes when the hips are a little bit stiff, if you put the cushion between your legs and sit this way, you can sit with your legs flat on the ground and then there's more stability. So if you turn the cushion and then straddled it with your legs on both sides, that might be more comfortable. Want to try? Turn the cushion up. Yeah, so you're sitting on the edge of it?
Yes. Here.
There you go.
And then straddle. This will work.
Okay. Let's see how that feels. Yeah? Okay. Good. Yeah. So really what's helpful is just to see whatever we do, because there's many different ways that what we do actually is something that we can sit with for a while. So we'll have meditations for maybe 35 minutes, 40 minutes. Yeah. And then when our back can be upright like that, then what happens is that we can maximize alignment and balance. So we want alignment of our spine and balance. And then the balance is that we're not resisting gravity. We're not pulling back from gravity. We're not pushing forward against gravity. We are balanced in gravity. And when we're balanced in gravity, then these are things that really support relaxation. So we're not wanting to force our body into a stillness. We're wanting to finesse our body into balance, alignment, to support relaxation. Relaxation is really important. Crucial. And when we're sitting, we can then continue with the theme of relaxing. Now it's a different posture we're relaxing into, but we can still relax. Relaxing the shoulders, relaxing the arms, relaxing the hands, relaxing the torso, relaxing legs, relaxing the feet. Relaxing the neck. So in order for the neck to relax, then what's helpful is that the head is balanced. Relaxing the face, the jaw, mouth, cheeks, eyes, brow. Head behind the head. So when we make an invitation to relax, we bring the intention and let go of result. Sometimes just the intention is enough. Sometimes it needs more support, other useful conditions to relax. So relaxation is a critical part of setting up meditation. Really important thing that we do. Because without relaxation, then everything else has a kind of struggle connected to it. There's a battle going on. And it's really hard to feel peaceful and happy when we're at war. So just taking some time to relax, to take some time with the posture to support the relaxation. It's all a very important part of meditation. So the other part of meditation is that not only what we're doing with our body, but what we're doing with our mind. So we can take just a moment and just take note of all of the effort that it took to get here today. And invite coming into present time. We're here now. And all of the things that need to happen, conversations, the duties, the emails, work, you can just park it outside the door. It's not going to run away or get lost. But it can be parked outside the door, so we don't need to worry about it. We don't need to bring it here inside with us right now. But so as we make an invitation to come into present time, we begin to work with the immediacy of what's going on in our bodies, to bring the intention to just stay with sensation for the moment. Continue relaxing and continuing letting attention connect with the body sitting. Now, bringing attention to the breath. So you don't need to worry about how you're breathing or where you're breathing. Not from worry, from curiosity. What does it feel like to breathe? Do you experience breathing? Not need to control or change the breath, just attuning to the breath, receiving the breath, allowing the breath, feeling the fullness of breathing. times are when there's thought that takes your attention, noticing that, and returning to the sensations of breathing. No need for judgment. No need to loop back into the patterns of self-harming. Just waking up to thinking, reconnecting with the breath. Letting the breath be completely natural, uncontrived. Beginning to feel the sensations of breathing and the effect of breathing in and breathing out, and how they're very different. Can you see the uplift, the inspiration, the renewal that comes with breathing in? Can you feel the relaxation, the release, the letting go, the ending that comes with breathing out? And checking your posture, just seeing if things have gotten tight and cramped, out of balance. Making micro adjustments that are needed. The body stays open and relaxed, balanced and aligned. But the breath is unimpeded. Then you can feel what happens when you breathe in, that uplift moves not only through your respiratory system, through your muscles, through the other organs. Brightens the mood. And when you breathe out, there's an increasing sense of release and relaxation, letting go. Find yourself sleepy or dozing. Let's see what happens if you open your eyes a little bit, get some more light in, and look up. Sometimes what's helpful is to lift your hands above your head. It can help bring more air in. Sometimes what's useful is to pull on your earlobes to stimulate them, or to bring sense contact, touch, with each finger touching, the thumb and the first finger touching, pressing with each breath, so that there's more sense contact with each breath. And sometimes what's needed after trying all of these is just to quietly stand up. So sleep is not an enemy, it's an object of meditation to work with, responsively. To invite people to do walking meditation now, and for those people who are new to walking meditation, I will stay back and give instruction. But what I'd like to also say is that after I finish the instruction, if people have individual things that they'd like to ask me about things that are going on in their practice or their life, I'll stay back here and we can talk. So the way that works is that whoever wants to speak comes up front, and then everyone else is either outside or just in the back here. So it's a kind of free-form thing. But it gives an opportunity. there'll be an opportunity for a group question and answer, but sometimes what goes on for people is hard to talk about in an open space.
Yeah.
Clear enough? Yeah. So I'll do instructions for walking meditation now, and if you already know how to do walking meditation, or and you feel comfortable to head on out, please do so. And if somebody could ring the bell in 35 minutes, somebody like to do that? Don't all raise your hand.